Blog Talk Radio.
Well, it seems like we have a little issue with the music going on right now, don't we, Jeff?
Oh, there it goes.
And there it goes. Okay, let's just cut it down a little bit. Here we go. So, how you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing fine. I missed my theme music. What happened?
I don't know. I hit play, and then it just, you know, it does the thing. Let's see here. Hold on. Let's have some fun. This is a live show. Screw it, right? Let's have some fun. Let's hope that the other stuff doesn't
Don't
work this way. That's true. So we got a really cool show tonight for everybody, though. And there it is again. So we got a really cool show tonight for everybody. We have we're going to be talking on the second half of the show with Yannick Besson, who is the star of the TV show now in its ninth season, The Murdoch Mysteries, which will be very cool because The Murdoch Mysteries is a fabulous show. I saw this show about 4 years ago. I remember seeing it on Netflix and started watching it, maybe 3 years ago, and started watching it. And it's fascinating because it's set in 1890s, so it has a lot of that feel and a lot of that Victorian kind of thing. And it's not really CSI, but it's sort of CSI, I guess you want to say, right? You know, because we got some pre-episodes coming here that were in the ninth season that haven't been aired yet that we got to watch. And it's kind of like... It's a really cool show. So we get to speak with him, which is kind of cool, beyond the cover, kind of outside the author thing. And we get to talk with an actor who's on the show who gets to interpret the things that are written and bring them to life. So that's going to be a cool thing. And then you did something really cool, and I want you to share that with everybody that they're going to hear first in the first half hour.
Well, we have a TV theme going today, and I was thrilled and honored to get a chance to talk to one of my favorite actors. He was on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. as Ilya Kuryakin. He is on NCIS as Donald Ducky Mallard. I'm talking about David McCallum. He has written a book, and it's called Once a Crooked Man, and it's a really fun crime novel. And I was beaming to get a chance to interview him, so why don't you roll it, and then we'll talk to Yannick afterwards.
We'll roll it, and then we'll talk with Yannick, and it's going to be a cool show. So here we go, David McCallum.
Started here. Hi there. You might know him as Ilya Kuryakin from the 1960s TV show The Man from U.N.C.L.E. or as Dr. Donald Ducky Mallard from NCIS. He has written his first novel, and it is terrific. It is my honor and thrill to be speaking with David McCallum, author of Once a Crooked Man. David, thank you for chatting with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Just incidentally, for the record, the name is McCallum.
It's McCallum.
There are so many pronunciations that people come up with, but I just have to let you know that's the one I was born with.
Okay. Thank you for correcting me, because I'm terrible at last names, so thank you.
No, not at all, not at all.
Many actors who've had such a distinguished career as yourself write a memoir when they're writing, and I'm wondering, why did you decide to write a crime novel?
Well, it all started when I decided that I didn't know how to write. I would read books, read short stories, and even read 30 or more books on tape. And I thought, you know, you're a smart boy. Sit down, write a book. Or write, learn to write. And so I sat down and put pen to paper, and my first efforts were quite pathetic. But I think I must have been out of work at the time, because the first premise I came up with is the idea that an actor is handed a suitcase with $1 million, and what would he do with it, you know? And all that was just teaching myself how to write. I did it for many years. I threw the manuscript into a drawer for many, you know, 2 or 3 years before taking it out again. And it wasn't until 4 or 5 years ago that I took it out and decided, this is ridiculous. You've been mucking about with this. Finish it properly. And I did. And in that, the ensuing time between then and now, I worked with a couple of editors and learned to put it into the shape that it could be a book. And lo and behold, a week or so ago, it was published by Thomas Dunn. You know, it's already gone to a second printing almost right away. I've done a couple of book signings, and people are calling me an actor and an author, which is something I never expected.
That is pretty neat. And I have to be honest with you, when I first picked it up, I thought, uh-oh, but you write better than several crime novelists who've been doing it for years. I got to tell you that.
Well, I've been compared to so many people that I admire, and it's very gratifying to know that my English teachers back in school, they knew what they were doing when they taught me what they taught me.
What was your writing process? After all, you're commuting, you're doing the show. When did you find time to write?
Well, with the wonderful addition of a laptop computer, you can write anywhere at any time. And acting is all about waiting. Waiting when, you know, they're lighting, waiting when you're doing a scene that you're not in, and waiting on the days when you're not even called to work. So there's always been enough time to work to actually get on with it. Because they've now asked me for a second book, it's very frustrating, not talking to you now, don't misunderstand me, but all of the sort of hoo-ha that's been going on over the last couple of weeks has made it quite impossible. I mean, I flew back to New York for a book signing, went down to Washington for a book signing, and at private places, and met all sorts of wonderful people. But, you know, in the back of your mind, you have this gnawing thing that they want a new book, and it's time to get the butt on the seat and get on with it.
I'm an author myself, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, good. And also one of the writers who read my novel and The Galley Proof, and it was very encouraging. He said to me, "Welcome to the world of self-doubt."
I'm wondering, who are the heroes and who are the villains in your book?
Well, my hero is he's a little bit of an, not the perfect hero in many ways. But his name is Harry Murphy. He's a New York actor, does voiceovers, worked in film, television, on Broadway. He's a jobbing actor. And the people that he runs into and overhears a conversation are three brothers who've been in the crime business all their lives. With many connections within that, but they've always managed to stay under the radar, and no one has ever heard of them in law enforcement. So Harry hears them saying they're going to retire, and at the same time, in order to make things clean a few things up, they're going to kill somebody. And Harry decides that he's going to save this man's life, and he's played gangsters, he's played cops, he knows how to do it. But, of course, he screws up his own life, the brother's life, and everybody else that he meets.
Is Christopher, is he a hero or a villain?
Christopher? No, you mean Harry.
No, I'm talking about the guy who's the accountant in the beginning and then...
Oh, Carter, yeah.
Oh, Carter.
The lawyer.
Yes.
He's a victim of circumstance. He's someone that, would never have gone anywhere near any sort of situation with a crime, where crime was involved or criminal activities. But because of the way he brought up, because of the way his life has gone, he is literally blackmailed into becoming part of the organization and manages to keep, that as far away from anybody finding anything about what he's been doing. In a way would have completely got away with it if it weren't for Harry.
Right. Yeah, and I felt kind of bad for him because he didn't want to do any of it, and he kept it from his wife and kids for so long.
Yes. But we mustn't give away too much.
Right, of course, yes.
Because the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation is going to benefit in a small way from the proceeds from this book. So I want to sell as many books as possible so we can send as many kids of Marines to college as possible.
Well, that's wonderful, and I promise no more spoilers. In fact, your dedication in the book is wonderful. My uncle was a Marine, and similar circumstance, I guess, is what I should say. So,
was he killed?
He was alive, but we went to the wall. And he pointed at a name and he said, "This guy took a bullet that was meant for me."
How interesting. Yes, I went to the wall on one occasion when we were with the foundation for a weekend. And General Steele, Marty Steele, was there, and several others. It was late at night, and it was probably the most extraordinary night of my life, because several of the people told the stories of Vietnam when they were there, and the people that they lost, and how things were, and two or three of them came up with stories, and then said they had never in their lives ever said this in their lives before. But it was just that night, by the light of iPhones and things, we were by the wall, because it's a quite amazing place. Yeah, so George is right in the middle. There was a documentary once on the wall, and they did that thing where you go big wide shot and very slowly zoom in, and they zoomed right into George W. Carpenter. Oh. It was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, my uncle, same thing, never talks about it. That's the only time he ever mentioned it. So, yeah, I totally... Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Back to your novel real quick. Is Harry's World of the Acting Community, is that accurate?
I think most of it, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
The auditions and such like. And, of course, the second book, Harry's off doing another job, and there's going to be more revelations about just how the show business goes in reality.
Well, since you've been in the business a while, what changes have you seen?
70 years.
Oh, my goodness. How's the business changed over this time?
Oh, I don't think that. I mean, they still make the same mistakes. But at the same time, the cameras have shrunk in size, if you're talking about film and television. And the great change is in the sound. We now wear microphones that are so tiny, and you can go anywhere and they can pick up what you say and what you do, and that change, that freedom to get away from wires and still get, you know, people use long lenses and people walking through the park and you're picking up what they're saying because they're wearing a microphone under a tie or under a pin on their dress. It is quite extraordinary, the difference in that way.
That makes total sense. So you finished writing Once a Crooked Man. What was your path to get it published?
Well, I gave it to someone who said, this is great, let's publish it. And he was instrumental in getting me a literary agent in New York. And she said, I love this book. We then worked for a little while to get it to where she wanted it. And at that point, it went out to all the major publishing houses, and we were rejected by everybody. And that was very interesting. It's very good for the soul when that happens. But she said, you know, they wanted this and they wanted that. And I said, skip it. I've written a book. I like what I've written. I don't want to, you know, go on re-editing. That's it. And I was about to walk away from the whole thing when I got a message to say that Macmillan, St. Martin's, and then going down the line to a publisher by the name of Thomas Dunn, that Thomas Dunn had read the book and wanted to publish it, which was a thrill. I mean, quite extraordinary. And his office is in the Flatiron Building in New York. And that's where Catherine and I, the first day we were ever together, 50 years ago, we did a photo shoot, Robert and I and two fashion models. And the first thing we did was right outside the Flatiron Building. So it was old home week. I went back to the Flatiron Building, and I went up to Thomas Dunn's office and met his associate, William Anderson, Will Anderson. And Will became the man that I worked with to get the book to where it is now. And an extraordinarily astute, gentle, creative man. Will has been the backbone of the book since I met him.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. And writing is rewriting, and also if you don't get rejected, you've done something wrong. That's what I always think.
Well, yes, and you know, you can go on rewriting things forever and ever and ever. It's so easy because you see things you like to change. And particularly, I read the book on audio, I've done the audio book, And when it's one of the things I do when I'm writing, I'll write it and then the following morning go in and take a look at it. And then when I think I've got it to the point where it can be put into the file marked, okay, move on to the next bit, I will read it aloud. And I find that very revealing because you spot things that you completely missed when you're just staring at the page. And I have a very good friend who's written a lot of books, and she says, I'm very lucky to be able to do that. She can't read out loud. She never read her words out loud. But evidently it's something that she's envious of and something I do.
Oh, I'm in her boat. I can't read the words out loud, and I can't even listen to myself after this interview, so...
No, we all did. It's the same when I watch television. You know, I watch Ducky and I think, damn it, I could have done that better. And then if I watch it 20 years, lots of stuff that I did 10, 15 years ago, that wasn't bad. You know, time helps with that.
Well, speaking of your older shows, why do you think The Man from U.N.C.L.E. has endured so long?
I think it was iconic in a strange way because of the Vietnam War, the Cold War, the whole political situation in the United States, the emergence of the protests against wars, and even, you know, Jane Fonda staring down the guns, or staring up the guns of the enemy forces, shall we say. I mean, the things that happened back then, it was a very traumatic time for the United States. And to have a Russian and an American agent working together to solve world war crime, and with an element of comedy in that too, that, you know, to make it a little lighter than the reality around us, I think that was very much a part of the success. And also, they liked me and they liked Robert and they adored Leo G. Carroll. Plus the fact that if you watch them now, they're on ME Network. I watched one a couple of nights ago. The screen is littered with very beautiful-looking girls, which is always a path to success.
That's a good point, yes.
And even the movie that came out, which Guy Ritchie did, I finally called Warner Brothers and said, can I please screen this? Because people keep asking me about it. And I hadn't heard anything from anybody about it. So I screened it. And they, you know, we have the ideal woman, Alicia Vikander, in that, who is just as perfect an U.N.C.L.E. agent as you could ever want to have had, you know, to be associated with.
Yeah, she's also in Danish Girl Next Machina, too. Yeah.
Yes, which I haven't seen yet, but I most certainly will.
One of the things that I do when I have a day job, I'm a librarian, I carpool in with a bunch of guys, and we play music, usually it's soundtracks, but one day one of my colleagues played one of your albums. And
how extraordinary.
And I have to say, loved it. Absolutely loved it. You actually recorded four of them. Could you talk a bit about your music?
Four or five, yes, at Capitol Records.
Yeah.
With H.P. Barnum was the arranger. I wrote the arrangement. He did the arranging. And David Axelrod was the producer. And we had a wonderful time. I had, you know, Earl Palmer playing, you know, on drums. I mean, I had these iconic musicians from back in the 60s who were all on those albums. It was, you know, it's something, they asked me to sing. That was the first thing. Would I record songs? And I said, not really. I've sung a soundtrack of the movies and things, but really I'm not a singer. But I could write an arrangement. And so they said, yes, let's do that. And that's when I met H.P. Barnum. So the whole thing sort of came out of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And I remember the comment, you could read a phone directory on tape and someone would buy it and all this. But I went through the record business, yes, for quite some time.
Yeah, it was sort of a standard thing. If you were a star of a show in the 60s, you recorded an album.
Right, and you didn't get paid to do it. You went along and they said, when you sell records, that's when you get paid. I sold 250,000 records and they sent me a bill. I never received any money at all from doing those albums.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, because they're terrific.
Yeah, but in those days it cost so much to produce, and the albums and the printing and the pressing and the this and the that and the next thing. I never quite understood that.
I hear stories about film companies also fudging numbers around to say, we never made money, even though, you know, I made billions of dollars. So
you just don't know. I mean, CBS is always saying that, you know, they're always running as a loss. But as we've been number one worldwide in CIS for many years now, and right up to today, and we're about to do the 300th show, and we have two spin-offs, I don't think they can plead poverty anymore.
Well, let's talk about Ducky a moment. I'm wondering, how did you get the role? And I understand you really researched forensics to get the role.
No, I didn't research forensics to get the role. I got two pages. When I was walking down Park Avenue, I got a call to go to Bonnie Timmerman's office. And I suppose that through the on my laptop, I got the pages. So I picked them up at the agent's office back then. And it was two pages of Ducky kneeling by a body and talking. And they, in the blurb, they said, he's a bit of a lecher. I thought, well, I can be a bit of a lecher, that's for sure. So I went to Bonnie Timmerman's office. They put it on me on tape. I then got a call to go to Los Angeles. And so I flew out to Los Angeles, and I auditioned for CBS. And then a number of, you know, with the other Duckies. And then we went over to Paramount, which was basically a walk from there. It wasn't that far. And I auditioned for Paramount. And there was one other guy who was there at the time. And he went in before me, and he came out muttering to himself. And I thought, well, that's a good sign. And then I went in and did the scene, and actually driving away from the studio and going back to the hotel that I was staying at, I had a phone call to say that I'd got the job.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So it was pretty straightforward.
Why do you think the show is so popular?
Oh, I think Don Belisario created a very good initial, you know, he built a good boat for us to sail in. He then picked a bunch of actors and actresses who basically play dysfunctional people but are slightly adorable. That's what somebody wrote about us. And I think that's true. And over the years, people tune into NCIS not necessarily to find out what the latest mystery is or what naughty Marines have been up to, but it's to find out what all the different characters are doing and who they are, who they're with, their love lives, and what they just enjoy the badinage between the people at the beginning and then the investigations and the autopsy. It's just kept its style very strongly. We have a superb collection of writers on the show, and they come up with new stuff all the time. It's quite amazing. Cool. And we're heading to number 300. And we're still number one drama in the world. I mean, this is quite astonishing.
I would agree that it's your character, the characters around you. That's the reason why I tune into the show.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, I used to tune in, you know, to Maverick because I, you know, long before I met James Garner doing The Great Escape, I just loved the two brothers, the two characters in Maverick, that television show. And that's why you tuned in even back then.
That makes total sense, yes. Now, I understand Michael Weatherly, who plays Dinozzo, is leaving, and I've heard rumors that you might actually you be leaving shortly as well. Could you talk a bit about that, and please tell me that's not true?
I'm telling you, in my case, it's not true. We're in negotiation for next year. The gentleman who does my negotiation, he said, stop telling everybody you're coming back. I said, well, I'd like to come back. He said, yes, well, we'll work it out. We'll see how that goes. And Mark Harmond said, are you coming back next year? And I said, well, I'd like to. If they come up and want 2 years, at the age of 83, I say, okay, I'm glad they signed a 2-year contract, but I can't guarantee I'll fulfill it. you know, the knees begin to go, and you, it's getting around is not as easy as it used to be. I did a Pilates one-on-one this morning at 5:30 in the morning for an hour and got really stretched, and I find that a huge help. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm having a good time on NCIS. As far as Michael is concerned, you know, he's come in every morning at 7 in the morning, usually 5 days a week, and it is tremendous pressure on anybody. And he is at the point in his career where he feels he would like to go and do something else, and has told everybody that he's going to leave at the end of this season. The wisdom of that, I wouldn't really go there.
Yeah.
But I tell you, we'd miss him terribly. But the other thing, it gives an opportunity to the writers to come up. You know, when you suddenly have to make this kind of change, it's a wonderful opportunity for the writers to make the show even more interesting.
What has been your favorite piece of acting on NCIS all these years?
Oh, the whole thing. It's just one big favorite. I mean, I don't really have favorites. I have moments where I've enjoyed myself. But way, way back, I think in season one or two, I had a leg that had the Semper Fi Fidelis tattoo on it. And we didn't have the body, we just had the leg. And there was a scene where I was talking to Gibbs all about my grandfather, who gave me a ticket to go touring all over Europe. And I went to all the great museums and about the paintings, walking all around the autopsy room carrying this leg. And it was just a sort of glorious moment. It was so typically Ducky. And I kept talking about my left foot and the movie My Left Foot. And I put the foot down on the table, and Gibbs turns to me and says, "Hey, Ducky." I say, "Yeah." He said, "That's a right foot." And I said, "No matter." You know, I mean, it was just a moment that I've never, ever forgotten. There are many others, but that one in particular.
The one that comes to my mind is the episode you did with Bob Newhart.
Yes, that was one. Working with him is fascinating. Because just his delivery, you have to learn how to play off Bob Newhart, which was it was great fun. He's such a gentleman.
So you mentioned that you have another novel coming, which will be great. Do you have plans to write beyond that second novel?
I have plans to get through today. In fact, to get through the morning. I haven't quite worked out what's happening this afternoon, but that's the way my life goes. There's so much going on at the moment with the book, and so much pressure to start, you know, putting together what might become a second novel. I've also got to learn lines for NCIS for next week, and I know that there's a problem in New York with, you know, it's probably the plumbing or something, and I'm going to have to deal with that. No, I have a pretty busy life, and I don't plan at great lengths. No, I just try to get through each day as it comes.
Well, what advice would you have for someone pursuing their dream, whether it be acting or writing?
Well, don't let anybody stop you. I mean, hello.
Hi, I had a major tech malfunction, and I apologize to you.
No, that's all right. We're back again.
Yeah, well, just like you, with your plumbing. And
you with, yes. No. If anybody really has a desire to achieve something, if it's strong enough, nothing will deter them. I mean, everybody tried to stop me acting. Everybody, all his family said, "Oh my God, you don't want to do that." But if you have something like that and you persist, you know, go on. Obviously, if it's something like acting and someone wants to become an actor, you tell them to go to college and get a business degree and then become an actor. You need some second, you know, way of earning your living. But other than that, no. Just go don't let anything deter you.
Well, that's actually wonderful advice. I want to thank you again for taking the time to chat with me, David. It's been a thrill.
It's a pleasure. Yeah, nice to talk to you, too. And when you say you've written, have you written books?
Yes, I've published 8 books, and I'm a reviewer for the Associated Press.
Wow.
And I'm a librarian in my day life.
Well, the fact that you like the book and everything, I really appreciate that. And thank you for your positive comments. They're very much appreciated.
Oh, it was a great book, and thank you.
Well, that was my interview with David McCallum. It was a honor and thrill, and I'm still nervous about it. Anyway, John is temporarily away, and the reason for that is we are trying to get Yannick on the air with us. So I guess it's one of those days of having tech issues. So one of the things I will mention about David's book, it was really good. I was a little hesitant when I was told he'd written a book because I'm a big fan of his acting. And reading the book, he did a very nice job. It's a really good crime novel with great characters, a lot of gray area, which is a lot of fun when it comes to those type of crime novels. So if you like a good crime novel, I recommend his new book. And now we're waiting for Yannick to come on the air with us, and hopefully John can get a hold of him. One of the things, when we were asked initially to get Yannick on the air with us, they said, well, it's called The Artful Detective. And I said, well, I've never heard of that. And then when I realized they were talking about Murdoch Mysteries, I was thrilled because the Murdoch Mysteries is a wonderful show. And it's one of those shows that really does a nice job of setting you in a time where history, the early 1900s, he's basically a cop, and he is a cop out of time. He believes in forensics and things like that, but the technology isn't there for him. And so how does he solve crimes outside the box, essentially? And it's a really fun show, and hopefully we'll get to talk to him here in a minute. And it's actually on its 9th season. It's just starting here. And, oh, hold on a second.
Okay, Jeff, how you doing?
Hey, doing well. I was just giving
a little
history of the show a little bit.
Okay, good. Well, I have Yannick on the line right now, so let's bring him on. So, Yannick, hey, thanks so much for joining us here on Beyond the Cover. This is John, and Jeff's on the line with us, too.
I'm happy to be here. Nice to meet you, Jeff.
Nice to meet you. Big fan of the show. Looking forward to chatting with you.
Yeah, and it was exciting when Richard contacted me. I'd worked with him in the past for another author, and he said, hey, would you like to talk with Yannick here about the Murdoch Mysteries? And I'm like, oh, that would be fabulous, because I've been watching him for about the past 4 years on my own, catching up on him because I love mysteries. Yeah, and I love that style of show. I mean, the one where you had Tesla on was one of my fascinating ones, because I like the kind of the factitious setting with the real-life people and kind of letting people know.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could just kind of, because we always like to talk to authors, but now we're talking to you as an actor, and so you are taking the words from what the author is and you're creatively interpreting them into another way, and I'm just kind of interested in that process when you started with the character and how you kind of got yourself created now through 9 seasons and 126 episodes.
Well, we started out with started out with books, and there were some sort of TV movies that were made. There were 3 TV movies made with actually a friend of mine playing Murdoch, Peter Outerbridge. And then the series took a whole sort of different tack. It's got some other aspects to it that were not quite as present in the books. The books were a little bit more somber. It was a tough way to make a living back then, but the essential stuff, the historical characters, the forensic, the birth of forensic science to help solve brutal crimes and so on, that's all still there. But we've incorporated some comedy and some different things like that to just you know, bring it to life. And I think it was a wise, the wise choice there, because the show has had just huge international success. And like you said, we're going 9 years strong.
Well, just so you know, in my day life, I'm a librarian, and we cannot keep your show in stock with the DVDs. I've actually had this happen.
Right?
I start to shelve one of the sets, and someone grabs it out of my hand.
Wow.
So they're very popular at my library, for sure.
Yeah, you know, I get stories, I get feedback of stories like that. People have a voracious appetite for our show. And it's interesting because, for the most part, the show is really, you know, a formatted show. Things wrap up mm-hmm. each episode and you move on. The long-standing arcs and the sort of, you know, season-over-season arcs are not that big, you know. So it's interesting to see that people really, really love it and you know, we get almost close to 4 million fans on a Sunday night in France watching it, and it's dubbed
wow.
there. And,
that's pretty cool.
It's wild.
Could you talk a bit about brushes with history on the show?
We do have a lot of, you know, factual historical events that sort of pass through Station House Number 4. You know, we have people like Mark Twain at the beginning of season 9. We've had people like Emma Goldman and, you know, all these great characters that have helped shape, you know, our modern sort of history. You know, we play with the facts a little bit, but the historical timelines are accurate. The fact that people came through Toronto and sort of the Great Lakes area and all of that, that's all pretty real.
That's pretty cool.
Now, the one thing is how the show's progressed from season 1 now through season, you know, all the way up through season 9. And all those episodes, I mean, you're talking 126 episodes. That's like a 25 to 30 series book. I mean, you have a lot of character development that goes in, you know, to every episode. You always have, like you said, you have the longer arcs with the smaller plots every week. So how do you kind of keep your character fresh to go from 1 to 9 and not have it stale, where a lot of those series kind of do fall into that rut?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think when you have a good group of people that are well established as far as main characters, and then you have, you know, your great writing staff, they kind of tend to write to your strengths. You know, for me, Murdoch is a fairly buttoned down character. You know, he's not too, you know, yelly, screamy and too sort of out there. So the guys try to help me be sort of the Barney Miller sometimes in the middle of the precinct. You know, so we get some great comedy, we get some great situational stuff, and then he's also sort of the eyes of the audience. You know, he guides you sort of emotionally step by step through all the different things that happen, and you know, that part of it's been pretty easy for me. You know, I say easy, but it's been it flows well, and it hasn't been too tough to go from new sort of crazy zany idea that they have to new crazy zany idea. You know, I trust them; they trust me, and we just sort of keep pounding history at the show and having a good time with it.
And you know, and that's something that's interesting that you just said, as you know, have to, and they write to your strengths and you guys, you know, pound at it. But when you first start off, they don't know you and you really don't know them. So how painful kind of is that process to get to that spot now to where you guys are just like in sync back and forth and you guys each know what each other wants and how to make the show better? I mean, was it one season? I mean, how is that a painful process that people, you know, who are watching the show just don't think about that happens behind the scenes?
Another great question. You know what? Honestly, I think it was the first 2 years. I was a little bit, looking back now, I think I was a little bit out of sorts trying to really find the right spot for my guy, trying to find the right tone, you know, that would work well for the series, that would work well for the viewer, you know, locally and internationally. I think after season two, things started to really get into a groove. And certainly, you know, after season four or five, we're really humming at this point.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the
yep.
really the same team we've had from the beginning. All of the key department heads are still the same people for the most part. We've lost a couple of people that have passed away. But, you know, as far as the creative departments and things like wardrobe, makeup, it's still the same people 9 years later. And that speaks a lot to, you know, the quality of the work environment, the quality of the show, and really sort of what we're all trying to accomplish.
Well, if you thought we were going to ask easy questions, I'm sorry to scare you here. But a little follow-up on what John asked you, but I'm curious about how you work with the other actors in the show. You sort of, I guess I feel like there's a big family dynamic to it. Could you talk a bit about that?
I'm on about my sixth or seventh series at this point. I started out acting over 30 years ago when I was a kid, and I always thought that having a great working environment was paramount, you know, and so I've always strived in everything that I do to make sure that that's the case. You know what? It's not always pretty. You have altercations, you have, you know, life, things happen, you work with people. And I think the key is to take issues head on and, you know, give them some light and talk about them. And, you know, everybody's always happier for it afterwards. And I think, you know, you're able to work together in a creative medium, which is already challenging. And, you know, if you don't sort of deal with the how would you call it? If you don't deal with the laundry a little bit, then you might end up with a situation you don't want to be in. And when you're in a creative line of work, that's really terrible. So, you know, I've been in that type of situation and it's awful. So, you know, I've always worked hard to make sure it's set a certain tone. And if everybody's working as hard as I am, we're in business.
That's good. How does the show work in terms of you get a, I'm just guessing here. Do you get a screenplay and like, okay, I got to learn my lines? Are you getting the next week's script while you're actually filming the previous episode? How does the sort of the production work?
It's actually that's one of the harder parts of the job, actually. So we shoot two episodes at a time. So a director will prep two episodes at a time. Some of our remote locations and stuff like that will shoot days where we'll do parts of two different episodes. We'll shoot those in about 13, 14 days, sometimes as little as 12 and a half days, depending on the requirements, the page count and the complexity of things. And then we'll get two new scripts towards the end of that, and we'll do our read-throughs and so on while we're finishing up the previous two. So there are points where you have like four scripts in your head. So, you know, anywhere from 120 pages to 240 pages in your sort of head at the same time. And you just got to, you know, in our case, you got to just strive to do your best because you're doing 10 pages a day and it's a fairly wordy show. So, you know, with all the science jargon and the investigative stuff and the procedural stuff, it can be challenging. But once you get into the rhythm of things and, you know, the pace is up, it works out.
You know, we deal with a lot of, you know, best-selling authors. I mean, guys that you would know, like a Steve Barry, Lee Child, you know, James Patterson, mega authors that we've interviewed and we've talked to. And the one thing that they say is, like, you know, writing is not a glamour business, but only people think that it is because, you know, you make a lot of money or you see your name, but it's like, it's not glamorous. So for you being an actor, of course,
yeah, my wife's
see you on
a
TV.
Writer, so I'm very aware of that.
Right. And so when people see you on TV, they're like, and then they see you out, they're like, oh my God, it's look at Jonic, and they think that your job is so glamorous. What's one of the biggest myths that people probably have no idea about how difficult it is? Because I was on the set of the trailer that was only 3 minutes long, and it took us 8 hours to film it for a three-minute segment. I'm like, that's painful, man. I mean, that's just painful every day.
Absolutely. You know, there are so many variables, really. I think, you know, at any given sort of job, you generally get to, even if your schedule is laid out for you, you get to set the rhythm and do things the way you do things best. And you are able to take a break when you're a little tired, and you're able to have lunch at, you know, a designated time, and so on and so forth. With us, you know, schedules can fluctuate. We could start at 5:30 on a Monday and end at the same 5:30 a.m. on a Saturday morning, you know, 5 days later. So your eating schedule, going to the bathroom, you name it, can fluctuate pretty drastically. And, you know, people are sometimes criticized, you know, for how they look on a show. And it's like, well, you have no idea when that scene was filmed. It could have been filmed at 2:30 in the morning on a Friday when you had no gas left. But that's just the way it is. The requirement was that it was at night by a lake with a lot of wind and you're sopping wet. I mean, who knows?
You've worn many hats for this show. You're the star of it, but also you're an executive producer and you've actually directed some episodes. Can you talk a bit about wearing the different hats and how you approach those different things?
Wearing different hats. I like the way you said that. given that I wear a hat every day on the show.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm a student of this industry. I have been for over 30 years. I've always been fascinated by what the director does. And so I have, you know, really, really observed for a long, long time since I was about 13 years old, just really observing the process, the guys that do it well, the guys that don't do it so well. And so that's something I've always wanted to do. And I've had different, you know, opportunities to practice some second unit action sequences on different series and different things like that. But in this case, once we got into the series, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, a lot of my coworkers and a lot of the people that I work with urged me to, you know, take the next step and to start to direct. And so, so I did. I felt I was ready. I just really felt like it was important to have everybody's support and, you know, everybody's ear, so that, you know, once I was doing it, I was wearing two hats, the process would be more successful and obviously easier, because it can be tough when you're trying to really lay down the best performance that you can, but at the same time, you're overseeing sort of the entire day's operation. But then also as a series lead, you sort of have that on your shoulders a little bit, you know, your mood and your the sort of tone that you set day to day and how you do things and so on sort of rests on your shoulders as well. So, you know, it was really important for me to do it well, but also to stay consistent. And so once I started directing, I came up on a couple of different challenges. It was hard to get enough sleep because I was just too charged and too amped up and, you know, your creative juices are flowing and so on. So you start to physically run out of juice, but then at the same time, you want to stay positive and just make sure that everybody else is staying positive as well. So those are the biggest challenges. Becoming an EP came later on, and you know, once it became obvious that I was bearing a lot of the responsibility of how the show operated day to day, just overall, you know, becoming an executive producer was a natural progression.
That's great. So I already am guessing now I'm going to know the answer to this question. Do you ever think about writing an episode or perhaps a novel?
That's going to be tough now that we know his wife's a writer.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know what? That is a tough world. I do like the creative side, and I actually have a writing partner for a couple of different show concepts. My wife is my biggest partner. She and I drum up ideas. She's a show concept writer. She's also working on her second novel at the moment. You know, we have stuff constantly in the works, and she's a fabulously creative person. I am not. I am a great interpreter. I'm a worker bee, and I can sort of take the written word and bring it to life, you know, as is required for television or film. But just coming up with something out of nowhere is the most incredible thing, and I don't have that at all.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, Yannick, I mean, this has been an absolute pleasure to be able to speak with you, and, you know, it's been fascinating to hear, you know, the behind-the-scenes part and everything that goes into a show like this. And in Canada, of course, the show goes on about 7 episodes ahead of time. In the United States, it just came on here January 23rd on Ovation at 7 o'clock. Of course, so many cable stations search and see where you find Ovation TV, and you'll be able to see the show 7 o'clock. So we want to thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything else that you would like to add to kind of let people know about Murdoch Mysteries?
I'm just really grateful for the U.S. fans. People are on Twitter and stuff every day, and they're asking me, you know, when is it on, what time. Please don't give us spoilers, but just keep us in the loop. And, you know, people are just so much fun. And it seems like it's available to about 50 million people now, and so that whole sort of fan base in the U.S. is growing like crazy. And I just hope people enjoy it, and, you know, it continues to be a crowd pleaser like it has been all over the world.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Good luck, and let's see if we can talk to you when it hits another 9 years. That'd be great.
Well, looking forward to the season.
Thank you very much, guys.
All right, bye-bye. Yeah, have a good one.
Take care.
Ciao.
So, again, everybody, that is Yannick Bisson, and he is, of course, the star of the show Murdoch Mysteries. Like he said, in Canada, it's been running for about 7 or 8 episodes now. And so the United States, it started on January the 23rd, and that is Saturday night at 7 o'clock on the Ovation TV station. So you can find that out. So it's Saturday night at 7 o'clock. You can see that. And, yeah, the next episode is Mark Twain coming up.
Well, and who's playing Mark Twain?
And that's going to star William Shatner as Mark Twain. So that'll be good.
Right.
So, yeah. So, all right, Jeff. So we are now on our regular schedule, and it's going to be every other Monday. So the next time will be February the 8th. We'll be back on, and you know, we'll tweet out who our guests are going to be, so you can make sure you follow us on Twitter and check that out. And it's been a pleasure, man. So we will do it all again coming up.
Sounds awesome. And it was a fun and a great show. Thanks.
Yeah, it was. It was good. We kicked it off here with a little bang of doing a little Hollywood. Finally got ourselves beyond the cover. That was cool.
Absolutely.
All right. So we'll see you in 2 weeks, everybody. Keep reading.
All right. Good night.